Money Radio, thank you so much for joining us. And joining us today, it's a pleasure to welcome Stephen Cohen. He is a professor emeritus and co-director of the Berkeley Roundtable on the International Economy at the University of California, Berkeley. He has written several books, and he has written a new book along with Bradford DeLong, the new book, Concrete Economics, The Hamilton Approach to Economic Growth and Policy, by Stephen Cohen and Bradford DeLong, Concrete Economics. Professor Cohen, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And thank you for the book. This was a fun book to read.
Well, I'm delighted you found it that way, because if you don't enjoy reading a book, you're not going to read it, and even if you do, you're not going to remember a darn thing. So, yeah, it's supposed to be that way.
And here's why I think it was readable and enjoyable. One, I like economics books, but they could be a little bit dry. You painted an economic story on the canvas of history, and some great historical characters take up the story, starting with Alexander Hamilton, going to Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, and Dwight Eisenhower. Why start, though, with Hamilton?
Ah, first, he was the most important. Second, he was the first. Hamilton was the one individual who was not just the tip of a spear, but really made an individual difference, besides being the star of a musical comedy right now, rap
right.
musical. Hamilton essentially, remember our American history we were all taught in school. America was always the country of small farmers, very little government, ideally no government, and this kind of Jeffersonian view. Hamilton, who shaped the economy right at the beginning, with a lot of support from George Washington, I may add, he looks out and he said, what kind of an economy is this? We are a colonial economy. The structures of our economy that fit this enormous empty land, nonetheless, were imposed by the British. That's why we had the Revolutionary War. And all we can do is ship them beaver skins and timbers from the northern forests, some grains out of the mid-Atlantic states, tobacco, and then cotton off the slave plantations. This is not the proper thing to have. So Hamilton said, we need industry. He said, we just need it. Visualize a different economy where we become industrially capable, important. And the way to get that, says Hamilton, is a high tariff on all industrially produced goods coming into the United States. And we don't want to level the playing field. We want to tilt it in our favor, because British manufacturers are just better than we are. They're much more efficient. And if we stay this way, it's going to always be this way. Bing, a real high tariff by, say, 1815, 1819, we were at 25% plus, which, given the cost of shipping in those days, was a formidable barrier. And by the way, America stayed pretty much the highest tariff nation in what we now call the North Atlantic, right up to World War II, when our industries had already become the biggest and most efficient in the world. We still treated them as infant industries. Worked, thought with Hamilton. He shaped the economy. And this book is about how an economy gets shaped into something new. It doesn't just happen. Time after time, government stepped forward and said, hey, we're opening a new economic space. And then entrepreneurs are going to run in, innovate, grow, profit, and we're going to reshape the economy. And it happened again and again. Lincoln, railways. This huge government support for railways. We didn't write checks. We still had, let's call it, small government. But we gave them land, vast amounts of land, more than all of England. And a government that could give out land grants like that, and the land was therefore the most valuable because it was right on the railway, is big government. Then also Lincoln and the Republicans that came with him said, hey, we're opening up what they called the West, what we now call the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
and be settled. So what we should do is give it free to settlers on the condition you have to live on it. We don't want large land holdings.
So it wasn't auctioned off.
Yeah. These days, one would say immediately, well, let's auction it off to the highest bidder. We would then have had giant land holdings, landless tenant farmers, and we would look a lot more like Latin America than an independent, robust democracy. They did that. This was social planning. And the Republicans that did that really knew what they were doing. It was not, you know, they didn't just back into it. They knew what they wanted. It's our job to shape the economy and then let it rip.
And it ripped quite well for a while, to the point where at a certain point, even though you had individual settlers throughout the Midwest, you still ended up with these monopoly companies, trust, as they were known by Teddy Roosevelt's time.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, once you got the let's call it the revolution in business, business got really big. Start with the railways. It was so important. They just dominated everything. They were the lifeline of the country. They became really big. So first thing we had to do is change the law, basic law. Railways were not too big to fail, like go broke, but they were too important and too big to stop working. So we all of a sudden just changed bankruptcy laws completely. If you go broke, no problem. The railway keeps working. We reorganize the company, and the shareholders and the bondholders, especially all those English investors who were on to the next big thing, and it was the next big thing. They kept losing their shirts time and time again. And we did that, but after a while, something this big, how do you control it? A market ceases to work very well when some industrial companies are too big to be governed by the market. They kind of control the market. The market doesn't control them. So you have a few choices. The ideological choice, you nationalize it. We said, no way. So we regulate it. Or you break it up. So we poked around, and that was in the progressive era. We like to think of it as the progressive era. You could just as easily call it the age of J.P. Morgan.
Yeah.
Same time. But we worked out a pragmatic accommodation to the new scale of industry, steel, railways, all kinds of things, that the market left to itself couldn't really handle. You'd end up with, you know, real monopoly power.
And then we go to Teddy Roosevelt's cousin, FDR, faced with a crisis. And he really experimented as he went along.
Well, he calls it radical experimentation. He tried anything. He was involved in emergency medicine when they didn't even have emergency. The economy, the society was in the death throes. It was a disaster. Disaster. So you got to do something. They had no plan what to do. So they kept trying things. They certainly did not. The New Deal didn't start with like a socialist agenda or a pure market agenda. They just were trying to do the obvious thing to help people. And by experimenting, because this was truly American, it was the high point of total pragmatism. Try it, see if it works. If not, throw it away, try something else. And they did it at a speed that was unbelievable. Something like two-thirds of the houses in America were in default by 1932.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Hoover had a plan. Essentially government lending against houses, government guaranteeing of mortgages. Okay? Nothing mysterious. And when they... But Hoover had managed something like 100 mortgages. Roosevelt got close to 2 million in a year and a half. Bing. That, That was the difference. We're doing this. And it saved the day. You know, the bet on liberal democracy triumphing in 1932, you know, when you had fascism, Nazism, and communism doing real well, the wild extremes, that was a long shot bet. And it was the same idea that our policy, we kept doing this, the different governments, Republicans, Democrats, whatever they called themselves, but again, Roosevelt didn't seek to open a new growth sector. He just tried to apply bandages and help. But it really defined at the end a new concept of what government could do and should do.
And then let's take it next to Dwight Eisenhower. Ike really was involved in big government as we would consider it today.
Huge. Huge. If you go today and look at Eisenhower, all the way through Nixon, same thing. You say, gee, they're commies by today's standards. Taxes were high. Government spending was huge. Deficits weren't. Okay, and Ike was the epitome of this. First thing, he steps up and says, hey, guys, we're keeping basically the New Deal. Let's forget about dismantling it and deregulating it. We're not going to deregulate finance. We're not going to can Social Security. Just forget it. We found some lovely letters that he had written where he says, yeah, there are guys in my party. They're crazy. What do they want to do? And this is Eisenhower. Then he said, here's what we'll do. Here's the economy you're going to get. The American dream. A house. A car. Beautiful highways, because if you can have into private houses, you must have a massive highway program and a massive mortgage security, federal insurance of mortgages. And that's exactly what we got. We did the biggest public works program between the Egyptian pyramids and the great Chinese urbanization of the last 20 years. And that was the, we called it the National Defense Highway System, because in case the Russians had to get around New York or Los Angeles during commute hours and attack, we needed those highways real bad.
Also, major spending on universities and research and spending on new technologies as well.
Yeah, part two of Eisenhower's picture. We call it like in a museum, the display cases. The center is the American dream. To one side is defending the American dream. We had a massive military budget. Huge. And within that military budget, it was such a giant mansion that there were many rooms. And one room was the basic military idea was permanent technological superiority, which meant massive amounts of funding for research and development. Hmm. And much of what we now call Silicon Valley, I've been involved in Silicon Valley for a long time. What are the key technologies? The transistor. Was that invented by two kids in a garage? No way. Bell Labs, the telephone monopoly, and also the major military contractor. Mm-hmm. Computing. Who would buy the first computers? Only Uncle. You remember this story.
Sure.
These massive rooms with hundreds of people running around replacing the popping tubes. And on it went.
Now, hang on just a moment, because now the story takes a twist as we move from Ike to roughly the 1980s and a big shift from pragmatism to ideology and what that means for us moving forward. We'll dig into that as we continue our conversation with Stephen Cohen, co-author of a really exciting new book, Concrete Economics: The Hamilton Approach to Economic Growth and Policy, Concrete Economics, and we'll continue in just a moment. Thank you so much for joining us. We're talking with Stephen Cohen, co-author, along with Bradford DeLong, of a new book, Concrete Economics, The Hamilton Approach to Economic Growth and Policy, and a great job of putting economics with history of the country from Hamilton to Lincoln to the Roosevelts to Ike. And then we get to 1980 and things change. It's a shift from this pragmatic, concrete approach to the economy to more of an ideological approach. And it really hasn't worked out so well.
I think it's been a disaster. But what happened is we got pretty confident, and it was kind of time for a new redesign of the economy. There were new pressures, foreign competition, for instance. And again, it was the same story, government redesigning the economy, opening up the new activity, and entrepreneurs rushing in, innovating and growing. But this time, it was different. And what was different was precisely what you said. The other approaches were pragmatic and concrete. And what I mean by concrete is policy. Here's the kind of thing you're going to get. Very clear. This is what you're going to get. Hamilton was very clear. Here's what you're going to get. Lincoln was very clear. Here's what you're going to get. Roosevelt said, here's how we're going to fix it. And on and on and on. This time, we got a lot of mumbo-jumbo ideology. We have to cut back, get the government out of everything, deregulate market, deregulate anything we can see. This was essentially our ideology in that there was nobody proved it. An economic theory came along as a handmaiden to ideology with all kinds of wonderful theories, but nobody set out and said, well, here's the kind of economy you're going to have when we finish doing this. And what we got was a reduction of industrial production of about 9% of GDP.
Massive increase in the financial side of the economy.
And I've said that GDP is almost like close to two pentagons because, you know, umpteen billion dollars means nothing and a percent of GDP doesn't. But a whole pentagon is a good unit to count things in. Mm-hmm. And I use that as a unit in this book. So we lowered the part of this economy that was in manufacturing, and we increased the part of the economy that was in finance by a whole pentagon. That is, finance is an industry. And then you ask yourself, well, we had a perfectly good financial system in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. It worked really well. In fact, every investment was higher, so they were allocating money to investment, which is what a finance system should do. Convenience was there. Mortgages were being written. Checks were floating around. We then, you know, doubled the size of the financial sector. What additionally did it do? I'm at a loss to tell you.
You included a quote from Jack Bogle in the book saying that basically the stock markets have turned into middlemen, mm-hmm. not necessarily helping the producer at all, not adding mm-hmm. to productivity, not working in a pragmatic, or shall we say, a concrete manner.
Yeah. The new redesign of the economy, you know, economic theory made it ineffable. You couldn't really explain this. You needed so much math. It wasn't ineffable. It was unspeakable, and for which you don't need any math whatever. What we got was we pulled it out of manufacturing. Then we increased the proportion of the economy in finance, in the processing of health insurance claims. And in a funny way, in the sale of real estate, all that together kind of offset it. Now, this is an economy. This growth has no substance. There's nothing there.
Can we return to a pragmatic, concrete kind of an economy?
Yes. One big reform in this age of crazy politics. If we can force discussion about our economy into, okay, what's it going to look like? What are we going to get? Concretely, how can I visualize this new change in the economy? We would do wonders towards reforming ourselves.
Well, let's let the debate begin. Concrete Economics, that's the new book, The Hamilton Approach to Economic Growth and Policy by Bradford DeLong and co-author and our guest today, Stephen Cohen. Concrete Economics, really fun book to read. You'll enjoy this one. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun.